Coming up on New York Now, a post-budget conversation with New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli.
You know, it's always hard to judge when there'll be a downturn, how severe will it be, what will be the impact on state revenue. But there's no doubt that we need to better position ourselves for when that moment comes.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Additional funding provided by the Leo Cox Beach Philanthropic Foundation. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan.
And I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Rancor in the Senate Democratic Conference is a keyboard shortcut phrase I use a lot.
Dave Lombardo will join us for some analysis at the Reporters Roundtable in a bit. But first, let's get caught up on the week's news from the state capitol. Two downstate Democratic lawmakers are pushing legislation to force the release of President Donald Trump's tax returns. The bills would authorize the State Department of Taxation and Finance to share return information with a requesting congressional committee and give the department the power to release the returns of any New Yorker seeking statewide office.
If you believe that the next presidential election is important to the people of New York, making sure the public has information about the man currently in the White House is something that I feel it's incumbent upon us to make sure is released. And just so you understand, we're not, you know, seeking the president's cooperation. We're not looking to the IRS to turn over a copy of returns. There's a copy of President Trump's New York State tax returns right here in New York State, in an office somewhere. And the only thing that prevents that state income tax return from being made public is a state statute that we, the state legislature, have the power to amend.
Governor Cuomo said this week he would like to see the law expanded and applied to everyone seeking to become a member of the state Senate or Assembly. Also this week, lawmakers highlighted legislation that would increase the accountability of the federal government's detention of kids held in state facilities. The Separated Children Accountability Response Act would require the reporting on the number of unaccompanied alien minors newly accepted, released, or currently under their care.
How do we know that the children who are separated from their parents at the border, how do we know we have the right number that went to HHS? But also, how do we know that we can still link the child to the parent, which is a separate issue? But what we need to do is say, listen, we as the state, this is a state that is a progressive state. We are not prepared to sit by and watch this Trump administration disrespect our kids.
I cannot imagine what these children are feeling, fleeing violence, fleeing fear, fleeing hunger, and then walking into a nightmare. The nightmare that has become looking for asylum, the nightmare that has become looking for a better life in the United States. We need to do better by these children and their families. The law is very clear. They are allowed to seek asylum. They are allowed to seek refuge. But instead, we are saying, let's use these children as a weapon against parents who are simply looking for an opportunity to help their children survive.
The bill would also require the disclosure of the median and mean number of days children have spent in the agency's care, how many whose primary language is not English, and the number forcibly removed from the custody of their parents. Representatives of New York State United Teachers held a press conference in front of the State Education Building this week, saying New York must fix what they say are the flawed exams for kids in grades 3-8. The state's computer-based testing system failed for the second year in a row, with problems opening up on the first day of exams. NYSA leaders, along with lawmakers, called for a stop to the current testing setup and continued their call for changes to the system as a whole.
Computer-based tests aren't the only problems we are seeing here in New York State. Stories from teachers, parents, and students continue to flood in to NYSA as well as the Board of Regents. Stories of developmentally inappropriate tests. Students as young as 8 and 9 years old spending 4 to 6 hours in front of a test that we know is flawed.
We have the best teachers in the country, Now let's give them the appropriate tools to actually teach our children and to provide our students with a learning environment. It's the least we can do. You've heard it said before, New York State, the number one priority for us is to provide our children with an education, to provide our students with a good, sound education. It is their right to have that. We need to do that. I stand here to say today, we need to correct the test.
The contract with Questar, which operates the computer-based tests, runs through 2020, and State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Ilya says they will seek proposals for a new one when the time comes. And finally, on Thursday, the EPA issued a certificate of completion of remedial action to General Electric for the cleanup of the Upper Hudson River. EPA Regional Administrator Pete Lopez, a former state assemblyman, called it a legal receipt for the company, but it said it doesn't preclude them from further cleanup if the federal agency deems it necessary. A few hours after the release, Governor Cuomo and Attorney General Tish James announced the state intends to sue the EPA over the decision.
All right, and now we're at the Reporters Roundtable, where we're joined by Dave Lombardo from the Times Union. So, Matt, I guess the question as we see the story about the GE cleanup is, are they done and are they off the hook? Because the advocates will tell you, no, they're not done. And okay. Pete Lopez clearly says, yeah, they appear to be done.
Yeah, they called this certificate of completion a legal receipt for what they did from 2009 to, I think it was 2016, the dredging. But he kept saying that, well, this doesn't mean GE's off the hook, but it also is not going to force them to do any more dredging. So what are they going to have to do after this? Doesn't seem like a whole lot. And the other thing was the final certificate won't be given until 5 more decades, you know, when you and I are long gone.
Right. And there are large chunks of the PCB contamination zone that, you know, the Champlain Canal, which
yes.
is at the northern end of that area, can't even be dredged because to dredge it to make it navigable again would churn up the PCBs and put a whole ton
right.
of them, or tons of them back in the
river.
And
there's still, I think, well, only 72% was cleaned up. So there's still a lot of PCBs in that area we talked about along Saratoga County, Mechanicville, Northumberland. It's a mess, but what will GE have to do in the future? It's really unclear at this point.
Yeah. Dave, this week among the issues you've been covering is the governor coming out and saying that depending upon the legislation, he would support aid in dying legislation, also known as assisted suicide, if you're an opponent of it.
Yeah, you know, this controversial legislation, which has actually never passed the legislature, now has new life heading into the final 3 months of the legislative session. The governor came out and, you know, said this almost out of the blue. This wasn't really on anybody's radar, but
out of the blue.
But now it's being seriously considered. Amy Pollan, who's a big proponent of it in the assembly, has said this really could give it a kick in the pants, but still there is that threshold, the fact that it's never actually passed the legislature.
And could be another potentially big loss for the Catholic Church, which is not having a good year so far in the legislature.
Right. RHA was not its, you know, big win. Child Victims Act, real things that it's was against, kind of came around on the Child Victims Act to some degree. It's brought on a new heavy hitter from the Pataki administration to aid Cardinal Dolan and the Catholic Church. We'll see what happens.
Well, let's see where this story goes, though, Casey, because when he was asked that question by Alan Shartok, apparently a person who was on that radio program an hour or so before asked them to ask the governor. So that's why it kind of came out of the blue. We'll see if it has any, if it sticks for the next week or so.
Another thing you were following this week, Dave, a rare win by the Assembly GOP conference in terms of kind of putting the Democratic majority back on its heels in terms of a bill that would grant free tuition to the children of military veterans who die. Not necessarily
Correct.
In combat, just die.
Correct. And when we talk win, this wasn't like a legislative win. This was a PR win.
Yeah.
Essentially, they embarrassed Assembly Democrats who killed a bill in committee that does what you said. Assembly Republicans appeared shocked and just amazed that this bill would die in committee, when in reality, you know, GOP bills go to die in the Assembly because it's controlled by the Democrats. And this was just kind of the worst underbelly of how Albany works, because, you know, we even had a Democratic sponsor of the bill in the committee vote to hold his own bill. He says it's because it was in the context, wasn't done in the context of the budget, but I think it's more of the fact that it was a Republican bill.
Speaking of the underbelly of how things get done, in Albany there was an outstanding story from Vivian Wang of the New York Times that appeared in Friday's editions about a blow-up behind closed doors in the Democratic Conference, this one involving someone who is unfortunately prone to blow-up, Senator Kevin Parker, and new freshman Senator Alessandra Biaggi. It began over the question of whether or not provocative social media posts were doing damage to the conference. Parker, who is famous for his bad behavior on social media and otherwise, said that it was doing damage. Biaggi pushed back and pointed out that Parker, in December, invited a spokeswoman for the Senate GOP to kill herself. That led, apparently, to an outburst from Parker in which he apparently ripped off his tie, according to the New York Times story, threw it down and said that he was essentially invulnerable to the kind of primary challenge that progressives have threatened to mount against veteran lawmakers like Parker, who they see as recalcitrant.
Well, I think this highlights the institutional versus, you know, insurgent class of politicians that's been going on all year. And not just in the state Senate. We've seen this in the Assembly as well, with Assemblywoman Yulene Niu, who's been trying to push a lot of things and running up against a brick wall in her conference.
A roommate of Biaggi.
Exactly. Yeah. And the third leg of that trio is Jessica Ramos, who's also been involved in some of these issues, like calling out the governor for a fundraiser he had, which also prompted a rebuke from Senate Democratic leadership, who were not too happy that they were raising this in the heart of budget negotiations.
When they were having their own fundraisers as well.
Exactly.
And I believe two of those three lawmakers had their own fundraiser within weeks of making that that kind of scoldy comment.
Yeah.
Dave's right. I mean, and some of these new senators probably had some expectations from the people who voted for them, saying, hey, we need some change. And a message to supporters, Biaggi wrote, now we know who these legislators are when talking about the progressive things they couldn't get done, and we will plan accordingly, kind of that vague statement, which Zach Fink asked her about this week, the reporter from New York One.
Zach Fink also pointed out on Twitter that his sources say that Biaggi said in that contentious meeting that she had done Parker a favor by not bringing his kill yourself comment to the Ethics Committee, which is a committee that she chairs, which is not really a good thing to say.
She is getting crushed on social media as we speak here on Friday morning. It's a very bad look.
Social media giveth and social media taketh away. So, Dave, we are now going to move to your interview with Controller Tom DiNapoli, who's been a regular guest on this show, always a terrific interview. He's looking ahead in this interview to the fiscal year to come and the out years, which might be somewhat cloudy.
Well, we really focused on, you know, did New York do enough to prepare for the dystopian, you know, future that he sees? And that's an interesting answer from him.
Well, thank you, Controller DiNapoli, for joining us today. So I think we need to address the elephant in the room. Are you ready to declare your campaign for president at this point?
Well, I think it's somewhat of a crowded field already.
It is.
Half of them are from New York, too. So,
but probably ruling that out at this point.
We are. I've always said the the one controller that became president was the legendary Millard Fillmore.
Legendary.
He was a good controller.
Okay.
Maybe not so much as president, but I don't expect to follow the Millard Fillmore path. He was vice president, and then his president conveniently died in office, and that's how he became president. So I'm not expecting a similar trajectory.
Okay, I'll cross you off the list. Well, turning more to New York State, you've been warning for months about the likelihood of an economic downturn and the need for New York to build up its rainy day fund. So in light of the budget we recently passed, you know, how did we do in terms of investing in our reserves, and is the state prepared for the future?
Well, I was glad to see the executive budget proposal, and then on the final budget, for the first time since 2015, we're putting money into the rainy day reserves. So I think that's a good step. We should have done it sooner, and we should have done more, but at least we're doing the right thing now. You know, it's always hard to judge when there'll be a downturn, how severe will it be, what will be the impact on state revenue. But there's no doubt that we need to better position ourselves for when that moment comes. So I think we're in better shape today than we were a few months ago in terms of being prepared with the reserves. But you know, the challenge for New York is that you saw it in this budget, we make significant spending commitments, not just for the current year, but for the out years. We're already a highly indebted state, so the option of borrowing is somewhat limited as well. So I do think, from my perspective, we need to be careful as we move forward. We're continuing to adjust to the reality of the federal tax changes, which so far have been very negative for New York. So, and just the general view that the economic cycle is going to be slowing down. There's a fair amount of caution that I think we all need to stand by.
One of the ways that the budget sort of plans for the future is that, you know, instead of putting an additional $500 million on top of what was committed, the budget includes language allowing the governor's budget division to make cuts if the state revenue is off by $500 million. What do you think of that approach?
Well, you need some kind of a safety valve. You know, the problem obviously is that if it's a one person's decision, you know, it's always preferable to have a buy-in from the legislature.
Well,
if
and
you
I
can.
Should say the legislature theoretically has 30 days to make its own cuts if
right.
you know doesn't like the DOB's cuts.
Yeah.
But it's hard to imagine legislators wanting to take that responsibility on themselves.
Well, even if they want to, given the variety of opinions that are reflected there,
right.
even though now both houses are controlled by Democrats, this doesn't necessarily mean there's greater harmony because
no.
the Democrats are controlled. I think we saw some of that during during this budget process. So, you know, there's more credibility when it's a more inclusive process. There have been similar kinds of mechanisms built into previous year's budgets mm-hmm. as well. They've never been utilized. So, you know, my hope would be that we wouldn't have to rely on, you know, the Division of Budget to make those decisions. We haven't had to yet. You know, it's better if you're going to do cuts mid-year to do it in a collaborative way if you can.
One of the other items that didn't end up being written into the final budget was a restoration of some of your oversight powers. In 2011, the legislature and Governor Cuomo removed some of your pre-audit authority, but it appears a conceptual agreement has been struck between your office and the governor to restore some of these. Can you elaborate on what this is going to look like potentially?
Yeah, so thankfully, after a conversation with the governor and his team, we did come to an agreement on restoring our oversight of the OGS centralized contracts and the SUNY and CUNY construction contracts. There was some back and forth as far as memorializing that in statute as part of the budget process. That didn't happen, but we're going to continue to move forward. There's an expanded role for the state's inspector general as well. So as the dust is settling post-budget, I'm sure our folks will be talking and just figuring out how to appropriately implement that. But, you know, there was some concern that, well, it fell out of the budget language, therefore it's not going to happen. I would say I don't have that concern. I think the governor and I came up with a good approach. We're going to make sure administratively that, in fact, it's implemented. And our folks will be talking to figure out how to do that.
And some members of the legislature have said in the wake of this falling out that they would like to see whatever agreement comes out potentially be codified in the remaining 3 months of the session. Would you think that have any problems with doing that?
You know, it's always helpful to codify something that's a good practice. And, you know, since they codified taking away the power would be nice perhaps if they codified it putting it back in. But I think we saw through the budget process there were different interpretations about how to codify it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from my point of view, if it's not done right, that could be worse than, you know, I'd rather have no codification if it's not done right. So as we implement the change, if there's a way to memorialize that, great. If not, I'm sure my staff and the governor's staff will make sure that we implement it as we agreed.
And during this conversation about these powers, the governor has expressed concerns about the timeliness of the review and being able to get contracts out the door.
Yep.
Has that been a topic that you guys have been discussing? Are you guys putting restraints on how much time you have to review contracts, for example?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. The governor did express that concern. Part of the agreement is to have no more than 30-day review on my office's part. I don't see that as a problem because most of the contracts, overwhelming majority, that we review are reviewed and approved in less than 2 weeks, often less than a week. So the 30-day requirement I don't see as an impediment.
One of the last items to get into the budget this year was a commission on public financing of elections, which the governor and legislature decided to punt on the specifics of this to a commission. So with their past history of creating commissions, were you a little surprised that they didn't name you to it in the middle of the night?
Well. Maybe I was relieved that I wasn't named to it. Look, my perspective has been pretty clear for many years now. We need to have public financing of elections in New York, for certainly for the statewide offices, for I think for state legislative offices as well. It seemed to be one of those issues that there was a lot of rumbling that something was going to happen, then nothing was going to happen. So I think you're right. At the end of the day, I guess it's good that they didn't walk away without doing something. You know, the concern is obvious. What will the commission, in fact, produce? They did throw in as well fusion voting as another topic, which, again, I've had my own point of view on that, which might be a little different than those that seek to end it.
So you don't want to end it then?
I think fusion voting has been a net benefit in terms of the political process in our state. It doesn't mean you can't discuss if there need to be any reforms. Maybe the threshold needs to be a little higher before you qualify. But I personally have not favored eliminating fusion voting. And I do worry somewhat that mixing that in with campaign, with public funding for campaigns, will that, you know, serve to dilute what should be a serious discussion about how you implement it? How do you incentivize smaller donors? What will be the implementation? I mean, many people have felt the State Board of Elections may not have the wherewithal to oversee that kind of a program. You know, so I hope what to me should be the first priority, which is getting campaign finance reform, lowering the limits, public financing of elections, that should be the priority. Whether that could be done in the context of a commission, you know, we'll see.
And finally, Comptroller, the legislature took it upon itself when passing the budget to introduce a special resolution giving a pay raise for Governor Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul. The resolution reflected the recommendation of the pay commission that you served on. What did you think of their action in terms of giving a raise as well as just doing it when they did it, which was in the middle of the night with very little notice?
Well, it's never good to do things in the middle of the night because that hurts the credibility of whatever you're doing. That being said, when the commission made the recommendations for the salary increases, we understood that for the governor, lieutenant governor, the way the Constitution is written, the commission could not impose that. So it did have to be by an act of the legislature. You know, in terms of the timing, that's obviously their call. So that was a resolution that, you know, if anything, I guess I was surprised it hadn't happened sooner, and they needed to get it done.
And they attached a requirement that be tied to timely budgets, which is as well as the case for their own raises. So what do you think of that?
Well, you know, there's been some discussion about that. You know, in the original legislation that set up the commission, that notion of budget getting done on a timely basis was attached to it. You know, whether that was good or bad or smart or whatever, I mean, that was what the legislature had baked into it. So I guess one could argue back and forth whether or not that had anything to do with the budget being done on, you know, when it was done or not. But, you know, look, from my point of view, it's been a very positive development that we're getting state budgets done on time. I mean, I was in the legislature when, you know, May, June, July, I remember August 1 year the budget was done. That's not the way you should do business. Local governments, especially school districts, depend on the state telling them what their state aid will be. You know, you got school budget votes coming up in May. So having the budgets be done on time, adhering to that April 1st deadline, I think is a good message that the state is doing business in an appropriate way on a schedule. So, you know, I'd like to think you don't need the incentive of requiring a date and then you get a pay raise. I'd like to think, and you look at the past number of years before this year, the budgets basically were done on time, you know, with some rare exception. But as I said, compared to an August budget, we've had on-time budgets for the past 8-9 years. Let's hope that trend continues.
Welcome, Charlie. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you.
All right, Dave, great chat. So there is more for people, for completists and those interested in Tom DiNapoli's own political history.
Yeah, if you can't get enough of Tom DiNapoli, head over to the Capital Confidential podcast where we talked about his appointment to the post 12 years ago, that very controversial selection process, and everything since then.
All right, great stuff. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, earlier in the program, we told you about legislation that would hasten the release of Donald Trump's tax returns. We want to know what you think in this week's poll question. Let us know at nynow.org. Last time we saw you, we asked, do you support raising the age to buy cigarettes and e-cigs from 18 to 21? and 81% said yes. Darlene in Waverly, watching on WSKG, voted yes, but said, maybe so many wouldn't be smoking, but then they'll find a way to get it anyway. Elton in Catskill agrees, raising the age will not stop our kids from smoking. They just get someone that is of legal age to get them.
And finally, William in Westchester County, watching us on WSKG, said the legislature and the governor should also ensure that if they legalize or decriminalize marijuana, they also make the age of majority 18 for that as well. We appreciate all the feedback. To vote this week, again, just head to our website, nynow.org. There you can watch any current or past programs. You'll also find links to us on social media, including Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at NYNOW_PBS. You can find a pathway to my paper's Capital Confidential blog as well. You can also get there by heading to timesunion.com. All right, we end the program today with video from beautiful Cohoes Falls, just north of Albany. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union.
And I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.